From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The documentary film, Who is Diane Cristal, is built around a mystery. A body is found in the desert near the border between the U.S. and Mexico. So in the film, we see the work of those people who are trying to identify the bodies and find their families. And there are hundreds of these cases. In fact, in the years since the U.S. began to crack down on illegal immigration, the number of bodies of those who die in that limbo between home and life as an immigrant has steadily grown. The film is like a visual poem, with the actor and activist Gael Garcia Bernal retracing the steps and uncovering the life of that body in the desert. He says he will never truly be able to understand the dangers this man encountered. All he can do is take the journey he took and see where it leads. Today in the program, we're back in Park City as we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're talking about the film Who is Diane Cristal? After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back in Park City for another conversation about a film in this year's Sundance Film Festival. The documentary we're talking about today begins with a mystery, a body found in the desert near the border between the U.S. and Mexico. And so the film is about those efforts to discover who this person is by the people who have hundreds of these cases. In fact, the numbers are growing of those who die in that limbo between home and the life as an immigrant. But the film is in some ways also kind of a visual poem, more in some ways than just a conventional documentary, with the actor and the activist Gael Garcia Bernal retracing the steps and uncovering the life of that body in the desert. The film is called Who is Diane Cristal? And we're talking about it today. And we invite you to join the conversation. You can go online and share your comments and your questions. And let me introduce our guests here. We have Mark Silver, who is the director of the film. He's created work for the BBC, for Great Britain's Channel 4, for Amnesty International, many other organizations. And Mark Silver, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Mark Monroe is also with us. He wrote the screenplay. Among his many writing credits are The Cove and Chasing Ice. And also at this year's Sundance Film Festival, he has three films altogether. Sound City and The Summit are also among those here. And Mark Monroe, welcome to you. Thanks for
being with us. Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
We should say Who is Diane Cristal premiered last night, and there are still screenings in Salt Lake and Ogden and Park City. We'll give you those details as we go along. We should also mention we're broadcasting today, as we have been, from the community radio station KPCW here in Park City. So, Mark and Mark, let me start with I guess the most basic question. Where did the idea come from? What was the thing that got you started? Mark Silver, you first.
Well, thank you. I've always been interested in, I guess, films about the division between rich and poor all over the world. What we did a few years ago was set up a website that asked people to send in stories of resistance against those divisions. And one of the stories that we received was about skeletons being found in the desert of Arizona.
And that's the thing that got you started. You started thinking about, well, who are these people?
Yeah, I mean, I literally had an image in my head, which actually I managed to film actually later on, of a police officer standing in the desert and seeing this unidentified skull in this big expanse landscape. And we began researching from that point onwards.
So I'm interested in how that image, so it starts with this image, starts with this concept. Mm-hmm. How does it start to evolve and become a story that starts to play out?
I think I found myself asking, it was less a kind of whodunit than why something like that would occur. Why would there be several skulls in a desert? What would that skull tell us about the world in not only about the individual, him or herself, but yes, why would skulls be appearing in the Arizona desert? And it was that question that set us off on a very long journey.
Mark, let me ask you, Mark Monroe, how you started thinking about the way this image would become a story, the way it would start to play out.
Well, when I got involved, the film was well down the line. They'd been filming for many months, probably more than that, probably a year or more, right?
Yeah, a year and enough.
And so I got to see a lot of images by the time I got involved. And, they were shocking and striking, and including the images with the family, which were quite intimate.
Yeah.
And they had shot some with Gael, so a lot of the film was already in the can by the time I got involved. And I was struck by just how tangible the journey was, how intimate it was from what they captured, and how very personal it was for Gael, it felt like, by the end of that journey. And it really it drew me in completely, not just the mystery, but the universality of the issue, the fact that we're always talking about it. So
it's so interesting because that is the thing that gets you there first is, you know, we see a body and the question is – and we see a tattoo. And that's the thing that draws you in. But that's not just what this is about. It's about the life that plays out from that. It's really interesting in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think having had an experience in the desert recovering bodies and skeletal remains with the sheriff's department and spending a significant amount of time seeing a significant amount of bodies in the actual morgue, I think I realized the narrative of the film was literally going to rehumanize one of these people, give them back what they had lost.
Yeah.
And that's certainly what we tried to do very hard was because, I mean, the great challenge of this film is that here your main character you never see alive, you never hear his voice, you never get a sense of him from him. And as an audience, we tried very hard to allow the audience to come to know him in some way as the movie progresses.
And also I would just add that it felt like rather than show that these people are different, actually, we are literally all the same.
Yeah. You know, there's a moment where Gael is playing soccer.
Exactly.
With a group of people. I think this was at a shelter that comes down the line. And we'll talk about the journey as we go. But he mentions those who are playing, the Nicaraguans and Hondurans and Guatemalans and Mexicans. And he says, and we're all on the same team. But it's the other team.
Right. We were playing around actually with a title a long time ago, and the film was called The Others.
Yeah.
before we discovered the Diani Cristal body.
Yeah. So how do you describe what this is as a film? I sort of made the reference in the introduction that it's more than just a narrative documentary, a conventional documentary. Mark Monroe, I called it a kind of a visual essay or a visual poem.
You know, we'd love to, you know, keep that tag, to be honest with you. I think these films, look, I think they're all different. I think they all form themselves in some way as you're working on them. They begin telling you what they are. And I think a lot of times people have an expectation that documentaries are kind of like medicine that you have to take.
Yeah.
I think they're entertainment. I think they should be entertainment and as well as educational. But you want them to be something that takes people on a journey. And in this particular instance, it's a literal journey.
Yeah.
But every documentary, I think, needs to have that entertainment value like a narrative film. It needs to take you on that roller coaster of emotions that you feel when you watch any film. And that involves entertainment, not just talking as delivering information. That involves a bit of mystery. I think all these films have mystery.
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, it was right there on the plate. So,
just say something about the concept itself, because we should say Gael Garcia Bernal is – I don't even know how to describe the role that he – because is it a role that he's playing? Do you see it in that way? Because it is and it isn't.
Yeah, it is and it isn't. We actually have trouble defining that role, the words for that role.
Yeah.
We certainly don't feel that it's a reenactment. I think probably the best description we've come up with during the process of making the film is that he was following in the footsteps of the Diani Cristal body, but also, I guess, alluding to something bigger and less personal, trying to be, if you like, following in the footsteps of the everyman migrant to just, as he was learning what the journey was like, so we learn what the journey was like, the audience learn what the journey was like. And in that way, it's just, I guess, enlightening us. Also, I should say, me and Gael made four short films for Amnesty during this process. And it was one of the most profound experiences that we'd ever had. We spent a couple of weeks on the southern border of Mexico in those shelters. And I think Gael, you know, took a lot from all the conversations we had with real migrants, and that sunk into him. And he, you know, that really helped on the journey that we had to take from Guatemala through Mexico back to Arizona.
I'd like to add that, you know, when I got to the story, like I say, a lot of this was already shot, and I had seen some scenes played out, and it wasn't in the form that it is now. It was very – it was a rough cut, and I saw just different scenes. And I, as a, you know, guy who works in documentaries, I thought initially that maybe those, some of those scenes were set up, that those were like actors in the van. And the first thing that I did on this film was actually go to Buenos Aires and spend several days with Gael, and it was eye-opening. I compare it to, I think about it now like this. If you really want to, if you're an actor, if that's your trade, and you really want to learn about something, that's how you investigate it. When actors decide they're going to play a doctor, they go hang out with doctors. When they decide they're going to play a police officer, they go hang out with police officers. And so I saw it more as an investigation by a guy whose trade is acting. And he went and he did it. And all those people are real. And that's, I think, what was so remarkable about working on the film is you see him interacting, the sparkle in these people's eyes, in knowing just what they're doing, which is going north for a reason, for a purpose, with intent.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's powerful. It's really powerful.
There's a moment where, at Mark Silver, as you said, we take a literal journey from Honduras through Guatemala, go through the border there. We go through – and I want to talk about – there's an extraordinary scene with Gael riding with some of these people on a train. We'll talk about that. But there's a moment when he's on a bus. Gael is on a bus and he's chatting with a guy behind him and he's asking him about his life and what he's doing. And the guy is headed north and he wants to work in gardening. He's a good gardener. He wants to be – and so they start chatting about their lives. And Gael takes a photo out of his wallet and hands it to the man. And it's a photo of his daughter. And it made me wonder what kind of connection Gael felt to this man, that this body. You know what I mean? The man that you're trying to uncover.
Absolutely. I often think when I see that scene, when I see that moment it's almost a question that I don't want to know the answer to.
Yeah.
I could see that Gael was, if you like, that's the exact moment where you wonder which side of the line he's on. Is he Gael showing a picture of his own kids? Or is he the Diani Cristal man showing a picture of his own kids? And, I think the mystery of that moment and, yeah, is a powerful moment, and it's, you know, it's great you picked up on that. I think that's a core part of Gael's role.
Well, Gael is also, I mean, he used to teach indigenous people to read.
Right.
He was involved as an activist in this peaceful uprising in Chiapas.
Yeah.
So he's connected to that land.
Absolutely.
He's connected to that people. And that really comes across. I mean, it must have become a really intimate experience for him.
Yeah, it was really intimate. And you know, the all of the people that we work with, all of those migrants, you know, they were real. They knew who Gael was. They, I would say, felt empowered to be part of the journey, part of the process, part of the film. In a way, in the US, those people are seen as invisible. Many people think they leave home, put a ladder over a wall, jump across the border, and it's as easy as that. And you know, the film explores and shows that there's a epic backstory before people actually even reach the wall and even have to deal with the dangers of the desert. And Gael, you know, lived and breathed that experience.
I would also add that, I mean, one of the ways that Gael and I quickly kind of bonded is that we're both fathers and we both have young children.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to understand the separation, particularly in this job that I have and Gael's job as an actor going to make films. You're leaving your family behind for days on end, and it's nothing like a migrant's story, but yet there is that separation, and there is that feeling of, should I be back home when something is happening? And I think all of us feel that. And I certainly think he connected on that level as he made this journey and daily thinking about this man and what he had to go through.
Yeah, which we see. I mean, we literally see. And I did wonder about that. So how did you follow him around and try to keep it authentic? I mean, it comes across as really intimate, but we have to keep in mind there's a camera there. And I don't know if there was a crew, somebody doing audio or so. I'm sure you kept it to a minimum, but there was someone there filming all of this.
Yeah. In the Mexico section of the film, there were two of us filming.
Yeah.
We filmed on the smallest but most high quality equipment we could take. And yeah, we kept the crew to an absolute minimum. It was at times a very funny experience. We literally could do one take before, everyone in that area knew what was happening.
Yeah,
and were there with their cell phones snapping away photos of Gael.
Because he is a celebrity.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a highly recognizable face.
It's like Brad Pitt wandering around.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, that was challenging at times, as you can imagine. So, we had to, act fast and intimate and move on. But as I said, the experience that we'd had on recce trips and on these short films for Amnesty had given Gael, a depth that meant that we could act fast.
Yeah.
That we had been on that journey before, so we knew, I guess, what to expect emotionally from each of those scenes on the train, in the bus, in the shelters, crossing the river of the southern border. We had that we'd been carrying those images and those emotions in us for about 6 months before we did that particular part of the shoot.
It seemed like there were moments when he just did become one of the guys. Like, at least that was my sense of it. It's like, this happened on the train, I'll say. For me, it was, he's not really Brad Pitt anymore. He's the guy headed north. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and the train journey was, it's all real. Everyone on board is real. The danger of the train is very real. We literally had to hide behind a fruit stand in a small Mexican town where we'd worked out where this train was going to pass. We had activists, human rights activists, who, defend migrants and the danger and fight the dangers of that journey further up the train track, telling us when the train was coming. We ran from behind this fruit stall.
Wow.
As the train was slowly coming through. You can't really let the driver see, otherwise he might stop the train and throw all the migrants off, which obviously would have been a total disaster for everybody. And, four or five of us clambered up on top of the train as it was moving with monopods and cameras and lenses. Yeah, it was a very real experience. But, as he says in the film, at the beginning, you really feel it. You feel the size and you hear that this awful noise that the train makes. And as you said earlier, the migrants refer to it as the beast.
The beast.
Yeah, and it takes a while to, learn how to ride that beast, learn how to surf that wave.
But then you fall into that rhythm.
Yeah, it's a beautiful moment.
It's a beautiful moment. This is the lyrical moment, I think. One of the most lyrical moments of the entire film is when he's up there. And this is where you get a sense also of the kind of sense of freedom that they're looking for. There's that boundary where and this they talk about this, the migrants that you talk to or the ones headed north, that I can't remember exactly how it was put, but it's like you're on the edge of death.
Yeah, I mean, all these guys know that there's guys in the village in Honduras who they all talk at once about this feeling that they're excited to talk about this feeling. And, they leave home and they don't know if they're going to return home. And then when they look at their kids, when they leave, it might be the last time they ever see them. So, yeah, when they're all together on top of the train, there is this great feeling of solidarity and brotherhood. And, Gael felt that and picked up on that really, really dramatically.
We need to get to a break, but let me ask you this before we do. I wanted to ask about the image of the body or the bodies themselves that you shot. And I suppose you could say that it's graphic because we do see dead bodies. But I guess you have to measure that against a kind of reverence. There's that reverence of this is a dead body, but then there's also the reality of the fact this is how it works. This is what is out there in the desert. And And in fact, more and more of these bodies are out there in the desert, which we'll talk about. But how did you balance that, both of you guys, in terms of the way you presented this?
Maybe I'll talk about shooting it, and then Mark can talk about the editing process. So I realized, you know, it was a hugely shocking experience the first time I was in the morgue, and you know, skeletal remains. Yeah. And sometimes not even, you know, whole skeletons, parts of people's bodies were being wheeled around the morgue. And equally, the Diana Cristal body was actually the first dead body that I'd ever seen, you know, out in the real world.
Yeah.
Part of me, I realized during that process, I just went into, you know, director of photography mode, hid, if you like, behind the camera. But there was another part of me, which I realized later, was trying to film skeletal remains and dead people in the same way that I'd film the family, in the same way that I'd film Gael, you know, on his journey, with a sense of beauty, intimacy. I felt like I kind of could foresee that once the whole film was working completely, I was hoping that I was almost giving like a sense of empowerment, a voice back to people who were lying in the morgue, that the things that they can't say in death, we were trying to say in the film, you know, with them, for them.
Mm. So you're a proxy, like Gael is in some way.
I actually think that one of the things that documentary films is for me is I feel like a go-between between the story, the people who want to tell that story and don't necessarily have the power, the political power to tell that story, and an audience. Like, I feel that's... in some cases, you know, the role of a documentary filmmaker.
And then you had to
put
it all together.
Yeah. And then I gave it all to Mark. Yeah.
Then we had to spend months and months and months looking at these bodies.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
No, listen, I was a journalist when I first started out, and so it was a bit of the, you know, detachment that you have for this stuff. But I worked for a long time with a great editor, Martin Singer, Argentinian. And that was the very first time he watched some of this. He watched it actually with his wife, and they had to turn it off.
Yeah.
And I knew then, I think I knew before then, but I knew then that that was going to be the number one goal, is to make sure that we put enough reality in the film to make people sit up and notice what's going on, without turning them off to the story.
Yeah.
And I think the way to do that is to live it through people like Robin or Bruce, the people who actually have to do this 10 hours a day and probably don't have the ability to remove themselves from it after those 10 hours.
Yeah.
And if we can make the film right for them, I felt like that we probably hit the right balance.
Robin and Bruce, we should mention some of the names of the people who are involved in identifying these bodies, and which we're going to talk about when we get back from a break. Mark Munro wrote the screenplay for this documentary. Mark Silver is the director of the film. Who is Diana Cristal is the name. It premiered last night. There are still screenings in Salt Lake, Ogden, and Park City. And you can go to our website for the particulars. We should mention we're broadcasting today from the studios of community radio station KPCW in Park City, and we'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back in Park City here at the community radio station KPCW for another conversation about a film in this year's Sundance Film Festival. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film Who is Diana Cristal? We have with us Mark Silver, the director of the film. Mark Munro, who wrote the screenplay for the film, is also with us here in the studio. And let me introduce Robin Reinecke. She is a doctoral student in anthropology at the University of Arizona, works at the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner, and appears in the film, of course. And Robin, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, Mark, help us set up Robin's role, because I think in many ways, so we've talked about sort of the immigrant perspective so far, but the part where Robin comes in and Bruce and others, and we'll talk about, in many ways it's a profile of them, the role that they play, the commitment they feel, and the responsibility they have. Before we get to Robin, Mark Silver, say something about that, and Mark Monroe, you too.
Yeah, I it kind of broke every stereotype and expectation that I had working in the morgue and seeing, including actually the sheriff's department, the way that people dealt with the dead, with such like retaining their dignity and sense of humbleness, and I actually didn't know at that point that I didn't know who would be characters in the documentary. I didn't know who was important to tell certain parts of the story, and Robin and Dr. Bruce Anderson, I mean, the feelings you get from them when they speak about this issue, it's not cold, it's not morgue-like, it's not apolitical. These are people who, you know, see this stuff every single day. And I guess it's impossible, you know, not to connect those feelings to the bigger picture. Why are these people coming?
Yeah.
What does poverty at home mean? How does the U.S. economy rely on people like the people that are dead in the morgue? I kind of felt that, you know, every time I would see them working.
Mm. And Mark Monroe, I think it's important to say that, you know, it could be that they were just sort of the talking head part of the thing, but it's not that. I mean, you really, this seems ironic, but humanize them as well in terms of figures and the role that they play in this story.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, when I first saw some of the footage and some of these scenes, I was in shock that there was such a place as this little medical center where just a handful of people are in charge of every body that's found or remains that are found for like a 200-mile stretch of this border, the 200-mile stretch where you're going to find all the remains. And it just seemed crazy to me that no one knows about this. It seemed that I didn't know about this.
Yeah.
And when you think about all how we rely for on our economy with all these immigrants, they work so hard in every state, they're everywhere, that we completely kind of push it under the rug when they disappear, and we are in charge of doing something about it, I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, they're the only ones in charge of doing something about it from what I could tell when I first started. So,
Robin, how do you see your – do you see this as a responsibility? How do you describe the job that you do?
I do feel it's a responsibility. First of all, living in Tucson, I think that we all have a responsibility to understand our border and to understand the humanitarian crisis that we have there. So I feel a personal duty to respond to that as a local citizen of Tucson and as of this a citizen of this country that is really causing the crisis at the border through policy. It doesn't have to look like this. Our border does not have to be like this. It's constructed. We've seen deaths in this high numbers for 10 years. It's gone on for 10 years. This is not new, what's covered in the film.
Well, this is an important point because this is one of the points made is that as Bruce Anderson, who's a forensic anthropologist with the Medical Examiner's Office there in Tucson, and another one of the people profiled, he talks about how there's a moment in the film where he talks about it. He says, I have no idea how many migrants cross illegally on a yearly basis. He says, I only know the failures. And he talks about how in the year 2000, there were 19 deaths about. I think it was last year or the year anyway this was shot, 200 deaths,
mm-hmm.
Sixfold increase,
yeah,
of bodies out there, people dying in the desert. And the point that you talk about is an important part of the film, which I wanted you to talk about, right around 2000, 2001, the United States starts to crack down.
Mm-hmm.
That's what starts to change. Is that right?
Well, two things happened. One, NAFTA passed in 94.
Yep.
And actually, right around the same time, the Clinton administration drastically changed border policy. So they increased – not only did they increase Border Patrol presence and surveillance on the border, but they increased them in particular safe, traditional migrant crossing areas. And what was left wide open were the desert and mountain areas. So, you know, Doris Meisner has been – she was the chief of INS at that time under Clinton. She's been quoted saying, we thought that the border – that the geography would be a natural border, that it would deter people because they would be too – afraid because the risk would be too high. And that statement was made 10 years ago, and we see 200 bodies found per year, and that's only those that are found. And I have records for over 1,300 missing people. So clearly what they surmised, that maybe the geography would be a natural barrier, is incorrect. People are taking the risks. They are willing to risk their lives. They're calling their families from Altar, which is just south of the border, and they're telling their families what they're wearing so that they know what they're getting into. They know that they could lose their lives.
Yeah. So we're going to lose Mark Silver here in a moment. So I wanted to ask you something that I wanted to get around towards the end. But I know what this did, and Robin, we're going to get back to this issue because this is really important, but we're going to lose Mark here, and I did want to ask him this sort of a final question before we do. So I understand how Gael was influenced and connected to all of this. I get that. How did this change you and your perspective?
It evolved me in many ways. I mean, professionally, I've never done, you know, a film of this scale and length. And that was, to be honest, a very steep learning curve. And it really couldn't have been made without the support of producers, literally everyone involved, pushed me all the time to make the thing better and better and better. And, you know, I'll be eternally grateful for that. On a personal, I guess, it made me reconsider what life means, having witnessed so much death in such a short amount of time. And again, you know, that's and that in turn, you know, led me to think about what is the role of a documentary filmmaker, what's the role of investigative journalism, I guess, even though this is, if you like, poetic investigative journalism. So it's kind of left me excited about the power of the image, I guess, like reinvigorated me about the power of the image and how that speaks to people softly.
Yeah. How are people reacting? You've started now you're starting to see people see this thing you've created. How are they reacting?
Yeah, it was an amazing experience last night. It was the world premiere. And literally at the end of the film, I felt like we had, for good or bad, however people react, we had put out this soul and this story into the world to do its thing, and kind of, you know, literally people can like breathe it in and sit with it and see how it affects them. Like, we don't really in the film shout about anything in particular politically. There's no call to action or anything.
Yeah.
But I quite like the idea that can sort of filter through people, and, you know, they can react in whatever way they feel emotionally the film has affected them.
Mark Silver, he's the director of Who is Diana Kristal? Mark Monroe is also with us here. He's the screenwriter. And we have Robin Reinecke, who works at the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner. She appears in the film. And Who is Diana Kristal is the name. It premiered last night. There are still screenings in Salt Lake, Ogden, and Park City. And you can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. The This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, again, we're back in Park City for another conversation about a film in this year's Sundance Film Festival. We're talking about the film Who is Diana Kristal? We have with us Mark Monroe, screenwriter for the film. Robin Reinecke works at the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner. She appears in the film. And we'll give you the details about the screenings, by the way, if you go to our website, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Mark Munner, I wanted to ask you about and Robin, you too. So there's more than Robin. We talked about Bruce. Lorena Tonqueva-Queveda, is that how it's pronounced? I'm not really quite sure. She is plays another role in the film that I wanted you to talk about, who also has a kind of personal connection to these bodies and trying to find out the identity. Talk about Lorena, if you will.
Yeah, Lorena and I have worked together for about 6 years now. You know, people like Lorena, to me, and Dr. Anderson, are really true heroes in this situation. They never asked to take on this burden. Lorena is an employee at the Mexican consulate. And, you know, these are consular officials. They never knew that they would be doing forensic comparisons, that they would be talking with distraught family members on a daily basis. Lorena comes into our office about, in the summer every day. And she has to, she's definitely seen more bodies than I have. She goes into the back in the morgue and photographs. She photographs their faces. She photographs the items with them. She goes over the case with the investigators. She takes in a lot, and she does a beautiful job.
I was going to ask the really facile, obvious question of how is this difficult, but I mean, it really comes across as something that. Do you ever wonder if you can keep? Can you do this for any long amount of time? Like, can you? Because it seems like it's not just about a job. That you're trying to find. I'm sure it's frustrating at times. I'm sure it's gratifying at times. But it seems like wearing emotionally.
Yeah, it is wearing. It's a lot. You know, the part of me wants to say that, you know, it's an honor to do this work. And I get so much out of it that I'll never let it go, which is probably true. But it's you absorb a lot of pain and suffering and anger. I feel anger every day now about... You know that another family has to go through this. I can only take in so much sadness. It's not my relative that's lost, but I feel angry on their behalf, and I feel embarrassed for my country that you know that here's what we are sending them. They've sent their child to us, and we send them back a dead body.
Just to add to that, I'll say you know it's absolutely heartbreaking just from the outside. I can't imagine. That is your job. The description of some of these items, Lorena and Robin collect, is crushing. You're talking about backpacks, clearly with what my mom and dad would call your Sunday best.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These people are coming up here with their... whatever will make them most presentable to find a job, you know? They're leaving behind their families and taking mementos from their children. To look at that every day is just, you know, it's crushing. And I'm on the outside, so.
Well, and the thing that's interesting, Robin, is that because we see you going through the, you know, you open one of these lockers. And I think you've got like 700 cases you were working on. At least that was.
That's the unidentified.
Unidentified. Mm-hmm. And you've got all these artifacts. You've got a little ticket here. You've got a prayer book here. You've got, you know, a bus ticket, whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. So you're trying to piece together that just from these physical artifacts, trying to make them come to life almost in some way.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, there's a combination of very personal, intimate items that basically are meaningless as far as identification, but they're incredibly meaningful as far as the personhood of that unidentified body. And, you know, in the science of it, we're really seeking out the things that are going to get the person identified. But I think, you know, all of us as persons in that office, we're also taking in this other knowledge of this kind of strange interaction between you and this person that is somehow nameless.
Yeah.
You know, a stuffed Barney doll was found in the backpack of one woman, handwritten letters, photographs that have been folded up and reopened and folded up again. You know, worn clothing, sewing kits, you know, there's just people are really coming with a lot of hope, and you can really sense that in their items. You know, they're bringing Spanish-English dictionaries. They're bringing lists of phone numbers, of job ideas. You know, they're excited, they're hopeful, and they're scared, and you can see that. You know, they're carrying a lot of protection and religious items in addition.
It's interesting also that they're also trying to obscure who they really are.
Yeah.
Which is ironic because you're trying to figure that out. So it's not like they have their driver's license, or at least I would imagine most of them don't. They're told, as we learn in the film, strip out your identity. You don't want to be discovered in that way.
A lot of them do carry their proper identification.
Do they?
And those are the cases that are easier to identify because we can make progress. We have a link to kind of follow. A lot of people do carry false ID media, especially people from Central America, because they've also kind of gone through the experience of being categorized as an illegal in Mexico. And once you get to the border, if you get deported back to Mexico, that's a heck of a lot better than getting deported all the way back to Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador. But yeah, people are trying to come in unavoided. You know, I think it's important to take a film like Who is Diane Cristal and not only think about those that have been disappeared in that they are missing persons or disappeared because they're unidentified bodies, but the system is disappearing living people. The people that are living in the United States as the undocumented have been socially disappeared. And I think that that's what you see when people are coming across the border, is that they're being almost baptized as invisibles, that they're no longer allowed to carry certain things from their other lives. They don't have this. They don't have rights. They don't have the same kind of rights. They have their personhood, but they certainly don't have they don't have citizenship in the same way that we do anymore.
I was just going to say, I think this is the bigger issue is that they along that journey, when they get to the border, they work so hard to become invisible. They know that they have to hide.
Yeah.
What that does, though, the contradiction of that is that it allows the rest of us to forget about them, to not count them as humans, to simply disappear them. And I think that's, you know, the great contradiction of the story is that they are willfully disappearing in order to fit in order to come up here, in order to give their families hope, and we are forgetting they exist, and that's not right.
I want to ask Mark Munroe about the one of the kind of narrative devices that you use in the film is this migrant's prayer. It's one of the things that was found on this body, and it's one of the things that Gael encounters at one of the shelters, migrant's prayer. And there's this kind of reference in the prayer that to set off is to die a little, to arrive is never to arrive until one is at rest with you. We talk about that as an element and talk about that theme because it becomes this kind of underlying current throughout the this idea of the prayer,
well,
this idea of death.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I wish I could claim any credit for it all, but that's the reality of it. The guy had a prayer, had that prayer on him, and Mark Silver and Lucas made sure, and Gael made sure to include that in their representation of the journey. And I think for me, within the story, one thing that is universal for all these folks coming north is the faith. And it's not just faith in religion, although there is plenty of that. There's faith that we're doing the right thing. We're doing the right thing for our families and for ourselves. And I think in order to undertake that journey, you better have faith. It is long and arduous and very dangerous, and getting more dangerous as we see from the news. And so I think that faith is what carries people when they leave literally everyone they love behind and go north.
Yeah. So. Well, we go to a village in Honduras, and we meet a family. As you can tell, I'm being really careful about what to say because I don't want to say too much. But we find a mother and we find a wife and we find a father and a brother. Lucas, were you there at the village? Were you able to go?
I wasn't able to visit the village. I didn't. That's the one part of the journey that I didn't do, and part of that was because I think that part of the effectiveness of that was the rapport that Mark Silver built with the family directly, and it's incredibly difficult to draw out when people obviously are in that situation. Yeah. And I think that from a production point of view, the most effective thing there is when you've got that one person that they absolutely trust and identify as the individual. And it was also very significant to them that Mark was the person who was there at the moment that their loved one was found. And I think that it's an interesting question from a production point of view, because often you're best served by narrowing right down who's engaging with whom and everything else. And I think that that was a remarkable relationship between Mark Silver and the family. And it's one that continues as well.
Let me come back to this idea that we were talking about before. Robin, something that Bruce says is that it's a problem of economics. And you sort of referred to this. And Mark Monroe, you did too. It's an economic problem. You know, we need this labor. People here won't do it. And we're dangling the carrot, as Bruce puts it in the film, in services from the north. And, you know, and he says, as an American, I'd like all Americans to acknowledge that they benefit from this labor force that has brown skin. And then, Robin, you say this. You talk about the fact that how can you ask them not to come? Say something about that, if you would, because this is another, to me, it was another affecting moment in the film. You say, how can you ask them not to do what they want to do, not to try to live a life they want to live.
Yeah, I actually think this connects in with faith. This is the hope part of faith. Yeah. You know, we live in a globalized world, and there's sort of two things here. One, the United States is incredibly involved in economics in Central America and Mexico. The North American Free Trade Agreement and neoliberal economic reforms that predated the signing of NAFTA in 1994 drastically changed economics in Central America and Mexico. And you saw a lot more migration after those types of economic changes. So that's one part of globalization. And then the others is that these people are experiencing the globalized world in many ways, similar to how we are. They're seeing the TV. There was a deceased migrant who was found with a little mirror, and on the back was a photograph of Orlando Bloom. You know, people are carrying the Tasmanian devil. They're carrying memory sticks, cell phones, you know, earbuds and iPods. I mean, we are not – the border doesn't – it doesn't shut out the cultural part of globalization. It does shut out the free movement of people. So you have this kind of flow of ideas and cultural ideals and values, and we are all establishing our aspirations and our hopes across the borders. And then at the same time, you have an open borders in terms of the of free trade for corporations to sort of freely plant themselves wherever it's convenient for them, regardless of the conditions of the local market. And then you have these walls, very real, very hard walls for human beings to contrast the global movement of ideas and money.
Bruce asks this question in the film. The bodies continue to stack up. And he says, at what point, how many deaths will it take before enough is enough? And there's the sense that it seems hopeless, but he also seems hopeful that at some point someone's going to notice there are all these deaths. How do you think about that question finally?
For those of us that have been witnessing this for a while, and I'm a newbie compared to a lot of people on the border that have been dealing with this for decades, the deaths are – I don't know. I think we feel like the deaths must be acceptable to the American people. This has gone on for 10 years, the deaths in these high numbers. So I don't know how it's happened. You know, something very successful has happened in terms of blaming the individual, in terms of this concept of illegality that has been deployed very successfully, and it's silenced the human part. So this loss, this daily grinding loss of life, loss of limbs, loss of hope on the border. It's not a part of the discussion. I'm I'm saddened that people are not more concerned about it. So I don't know if, like Bruce said, that there's a number, you know, of bodies that we hit that then people will freak out and decide that we need change, because I think I'm afraid that people are still not seeing those that are dying as fully human.
Robin Reinecke, thank you very much for being with us, by the way, today.
Thank you.
Lucas Ochoa, thank you very much.
Thank
Great
you.
To have you here. And Mark Monroe, who wrote the screenplay for the film, who is Diane Kristal. Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Our thanks to Mark Silver, who's the director of the film. We should say tonight at 6 o'clock, there's a wait list for a screening at the Salt Lake City Library. Still tickets for Sunday's screening in Ogden. Wait lists for screenings next week in Park City. But for all those details, just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to our hosts here at KPCW. The show was directed today by KPCW's Mario Heeb. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.